Welcome to Main Street for this Tuesday, August 26, 2025. I'm Eric Etheridge, and for the vacationing Craig Blumenschein all this week, it's so nice to have you along. Coming up later in the program, Tom Ezern shares a Plains Volk essay and the story of a celebrated North Dakota librarian and frustrated author. And we'll spotlight an artist that Mike Olson has been playing on his Roots Rock and Jazz stream and into the music program over the years, the folk blues guitarist and singer Chris Whitley. You'll also hear how the apple didn't fall far from the tree in the music of his daughter, Trixie. But first, how's your back feeling? What about your hands and wrists? Yep, poor posture and bad office furniture can lead to workplace injuries, for sure. Craig is going to talk to somebody right now who can help.
And we are pleased to be joined on Main Street today by Crystal Nelson, the founder and owner of Fargo Ergonomics, North Dakota's only board-certified professional ergonomist. Is she with a Master's of Science in Occupational Therapy and specialized credentials, including Certified Ergonomics Assessment Specialist and Remote Ergonomics Assessment Specialist. Crystal combines clinical expertise with real-world application to transform workspaces across offices, industrial healthcare, and even remote settings. Crystal, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you for having me.
I think oftentimes this is something that is maybe not thought about, at least not thought about to an extent that it should be. And can you begin by explaining what is ergonomics and why does it matter? Why should it matter to me in my little office?
Sure. So ergonomics, from a very grand view, looks at how we're positioning our bodies within the space that we're in. So a lot of people think of ergonomics at work, but it plays a role in everything that we do, from driving to sleeping to washing dishes to pushing a shopping cart. There are ideal neutral positions, so how our body is designed to be positioned into the environment that we are in all day, every day.
So I think people think, okay, ergonomics, I've seen those fancy-dancy office chairs, and they cost a ton. Can you clarify what the field really encompasses?
Sure. So there are four different specific areas to ergonomics. When we think of an office chair, a height-adjustable desk, maybe a crane or a lift in a manufacturing facility, those are all focused on our physical ergonomics. So things we can do in our actual physical environment that we can touch and change. There's also organizational ergonomics. So when we look at how an entire business or facility is organized from upper management all the way down to the last person that was hired, everyone plays a role in that system. And then we have environmental ergonomics. So that looks at vibrations, temperatures that we're working in, and sound as well. So those things can affect how we feel during our day and during our work day. So for example, if you're ever driving in a busy city and if you've ever had to turn the radio down to see better, that's part of our environmental ergonomics and somewhat of our cognitive ergonomics, where we can only process so much information at one time. So going deeper into cognitive ergonomics, that's our fourth pillar. And that is where we are understanding how much information our brain can process. If we look at an app or a software, we're also analyzing how easily accessible some things are within that software program as well.
What inspired you to transform, I guess, from an occupational therapist to founding Fargo Ergonomics?
That is a really good question. So being in the rehab world, I got to see firsthand what could happen if someone wasn't applying some ergonomic principles to their day. And in 2010, I had the opportunity to apply some of the ergonomic principles that I learned in college to some simple office ergonomic assessments. And it was incredibly rewarding to me and my client to quickly offer solutions to improve their day. So it was more from a preventative perspective, where I got to see the quick reward come in for both of us, the client and me. And from that point, then I knew immediately that I wanted to continue to dig into the world of ergonomics. And being being an innovator or maybe someone who maybe pushes the limits a little bit more, I wanted to see what I could do locally in Fargo to see if something like this could be successful. So then I started Fargo Ergonomics on the side when I already owned an outpatient physical and occupational therapy clinic. And then I was able to see some success from having that small company of Fargo Ergonomics. And after seeing that success and seeing the reward and the potential that I could see my clients and helping them, I knew that I needed to transition full-time into that role. And I've never looked back since then.
So give me an idea of the focus then on your certification program that allowed you to have more expertise when it comes to ergonomics.
Yes. So being an ergonomist, there are some certifications that everyone has access to. There are different schools around the U.S. that you can get some online certifications. But I wanted to take it a step further. I wanted to become a board certified professional ergonomist. So now I have the credentials CPE behind my name. So in order to be considered a board certified professional ergonomist, that allows me to have that gold standard when it comes to ergonomics. With that certification, I had to have college level courses that were applicable to that credentialing process. I had to have 3 years full-time experience as an ergonomist. I had to submit, I think it was 6 examples of work that I had done. And I had to take my boards, which I took my boards as an occupational therapist. So now I took my boards again as a professional ergonomist, which was a 3-hour exam. And I think the last exam that I took, the pass rate was only at 35%. So I feel very fortunate that I was able to pass that exam and finally get those credentials that I feel like I've been working forever on trying to achieve.
Oh, congratulations about that for sure. You do assessments to prevent work-related injuries, and I'm guessing maybe that might be one of the more important things that you do. Can you give us an example or two where simple changes just made a big difference?
Sure, absolutely. One thing that comes to mind was, it was in a manufacturing facility many years ago, and there was a safety manager involved. And the safety manager had me come in because they were able to identify an area of their workplace where they were having more injuries than another area. But together as a team, they were having a tough time figuring it out. So I came in, did an assessment, analyzed a few of their work areas, and we were finding that most of the injuries were happening when the workers didn't have to lift as much, which is interesting because you think that if you have to lift more and the item is heavier, you're going to have more injuries in that area. So this was not the case. So what I figured out was that the area where people had to lift more were doing a really good job of using carts and hoists and those types of things to lift the heavier items. But in the lighter weight areas, they were holding their scanning tool, which they used to pick items in one hand, and then they would twist, turn, and bend to lift a lighter weight 20-pound item in the other hand. So they were creating a very unequal weight distribution to grab that lighter weight item.
Is that the common challenge that you really work a lot with relative to lifting, et cetera? And I'm thinking of industrial situations, healthcare situations, office situations.
So a lot of the things that I feel like I'm addressing are a very cost-effective or a no-cost solution to get people into a better position. And most of the time, especially here in North Dakota, I'm educating every single day, every single week to help people understand what ergonomics are and what we should be looking for when we are trying to improve an ergonomic situation.
Enjoying our conversation with Crystal Nelson. She's the founder and owner of Fargo Ergonomics. She's a former occupational therapist and now a certified ergonomist. Sometimes I equate topics that you talk about with expense. I bet that's a myth.
Yeah, I would say for me personally, when I provide solutions, I want to provide a no cost or minimal cost solution first. And then if that can't get the job done, then we'll work our way up to something that could be more expensive.
Ergonomics isn't just for offices or industrial spaces or healthcare settings. It also is at home. People who work in a home office, remote workers, students. What are some things that they should consider?
The biggest thing to consider is that working from a laptop is not an ergonomic solution, which most people know that. They'll even say to me, oh gosh, Crystal, you don't want to see how I work from home. I just sit on my couch working on a laptop. And there's no judgment, but the best thing to do is to just get up, move around, prop up your laptop on your table or your counter so the top frame of it is at your eyebrow height, and get an external keyboard and mouse so you are able to maintain a neutral neck position and you're able to move your arms a bit more freely as well.
Relative to cars, I've thought about this in preparing to visit with you. We don't have a lot of options on how we can sit, but we do have some options on how we control our position, et cetera. What advice do you have for us, especially those of us who oftentimes drive long distances or might even be listening, driving their truck as we speak?
The first item is to take some time out to get out and stretch. So in ergonomics, our goal is to change positions as frequently as possible. So the longer we are in one position, the more negative effects it has on your body. So sitting for too long is no good, standing for too long is no good, and laying down for too long is no good. So get up and move. The other thing is to watch where your mirrors are set, so your rear view mirror and your side mirrors. So sometimes as we're driving for longer periods of time, we tend to slouch in our chair. So instead of adjusting your rear view mirror to accommodate your slouched position, check your posture and readjust your posture to match up to your rear view mirror position to help maintain that good upright posture.
Okay, we get to play a game now of good idea or bad idea.
Ooh, this is fun.
Treadmills under desks.
Okay, so treadmills under our desks, those are a really big trend right now. For that, it was yoga balls. Are those a good chair? Okay, so treadmills under our desks. If you want them, there are a few things to consider. Number one, I don't really recommend them because if you need to get your steps in, you're going to have far more productivity if you just step away from your desk for like your 15-minute morning break, your 15-minute afternoon break, and then every hour get up and get a few steps in. When you add a treadmill desk to your workstation, you have to physically lift it and put it there. So it creates some strain and some awkward postures when you're lifting and moving things around. It also creates a challenge for your brain. So you have to think about walking. Think about those people that have a tough time walking and chewing gum. Okay, so now we're walking, we're thinking of information that we need to put on a spreadsheet, and we have to type in mouse and maybe answer some chats on the side. So now it's cognitive overload. There's too much information that our brain has to process. Also, if we're typing and mousing while walking on a treadmill, it doesn't allow our body to move in its natural reciprocal motion. So what I mean by that is when your left leg swings forward, your right arm swings forward. So when you're walking, our body wants to move in that reciprocal motion where you're alternating arm swings with leg swings. If you're typing and mousing, your arms don't get to swing, and your legs, your hips, and your back are now trying to compensate for that weight shift of motion. The last point is that people sometimes feel that having a treadmill desk is a good workout so they can get their steps in. However, we're not challenging our cardio system at all while we're on a walking treadmill. So the walking pad or the treadmill desk would not be a substitute for a workout. So at the end of the day, I say save your money, go to the gym, get up from your desk, and you really don't need the walking pad.
Let's go with one you've already mentioned. Good idea, bad idea, yoga balls for a chair.
Ooh, okay. Yoga balls are also really good for the gym. Okay, so when we are sitting in a chair, we want good support throughout our legs, throughout our backrest and our armrests. When we don't get that support, such as when you're sitting on a yoga ball, we're challenging our musculoskeletal system and our balance system, so to say. So our body is being challenged to maintain that balanced upright position on a very small surface for long periods of time. Usually at about 15 minutes, our body will tap out and say, I'm tired and I can't hold that position anymore. And then we end up slouching. And also people fall off of them and they pop too.
Raiseable desks. I've seen them come into offices and 6 months later, they're out of there because for whatever reason, good idea, bad idea.
Height adjustable desks are a really good idea, especially if they are the full height adjustable desk with a push button, electronic height adjustable option where you can push them up or down. So that is a good system for us as humans to be able to easily go into sitting and standing. However, if we go from sitting at a desk for 8 hours a day, and that's what we've been doing for the last 5 to 10 years, it's going to be a big challenge to get used to that height adjustable desk. So you actually have to create a new habit within your workday to get used to your height adjustable desk. Your body won't automatically say, hey, let's get up and stand. So implementing a new habit, so every other hour, or I would say once in the morning and once in the afternoon, put yourself on a schedule where you're standing for 5 to 15 minutes and then sit down for the remaining time. Continue to get up every hour as well. Once you get used to that goal, then you try to do it every other hour. And then your final goal would be to get up every hour for 5 to 15 minutes. With height adjustable desks, they are not designed for you to be standing all day. Standing all day is not a good option because it doesn't allow the fluids in your body to circulate from head to toe because of gravity. So move, change positions, and don't stay in a position for too long.
Couple more rounds of good idea or bad idea. Mm-hmm. This debate has happened in offices that I've worked in. Bright light, dim light, and just my computer screen. What are your thoughts?
If you are only looking at a computer screen and you're not referencing any paperwork, it is okay to not have much light within your workstation. Natural light is great for our brain and great for the energy that we have throughout the day. If you have a window that you can open the blinds on, have that at a 90 degree position from your computer. If you need to look at a computer monitor and reference some paper documents, then you would want some task lights or overhead lights. You also want to make sure that the brightness of your computer screen is not too bright in comparison to the ambient lighting within your workspace. Too much light can cause a lot of headaches, eye strain, and eye fatigue. If that is a situation that you cannot control, you can wear a baseball cap so the visor can block out some of the light coming in. You can place some plants in your workplace that are kind of positioned overhead. There's also some shade umbrellas that are designed. There are also some shade umbrellas that are designed for some cubicles to help block out that light as well. So too much light is no good. Absolute darkness is not something that I readily recommend. You should have some sort of ambient light to match up with the light coming from your computer.
Last question here about kind of the areas in which we work. What color paint should I use in my office if I'm working maybe remotely? It might be different than the color of a bedroom.
Sure. Oh, that is a tricky question because now we're talking individual personalities. So if we look at some of the psychological components of colors, so yellow is very alerting and stimulating. Apple green, that's more of a calming color. So it depends what you want in your workday. Do you want to be calm? Do you want to have more energy? Do you want more light to reflect from the walls to give you more light within your space? Do you want darker walls to create an additional calming effect. So those are, I would say those are more individual choices within your workday.
A couple of questions about your business. You've embraced social platforms. You offer virtual assessments. How is that component of what you do, I guess, impact what you do?
That has allowed me to meet with people who don't have access to an ergonomist within their community. So some of those rural workplaces, or maybe someone who is in a workplace where their company isn't providing those services and they have to pay out of pocket for them, they can find me online and get the consultation that they need. Most of my virtual assessments are for office workers. So I have them take a few pictures, gather some information beforehand, and then I analyze that, and together we go through some recommendations to improve their setup.
As we wrap up our conversation, Crystal, give us one tip that we all can take home and implement today, whether we're at home, whether we're in the car, whether we're at school. What can we do that can make a noticeable difference?
Ideally, in a perfect world, I would love it if you could get up every 30 minutes, but aim for every 60 minutes. So whether you are in a manufacturing facility and you're assembling products, every 60 minutes, move around, stretch, find something different to look at. If you're at a desk, get up and move around. If you're at home after work and sometimes you just want to sit on that couch that sucks you in, make sure you get up and move around, get a healthy snack, and stay active.
I was hoping you were going to add, Crystal, what we should do when we're binge watching like The Hunting Wives or something like that. After we're home from work, right? We need to be conscious of moving for sure. My guest has been Crystal Nelson. She's the founder and owner of Fargo Ergonomics. She's North Dakota's only board-certified professional ergonomist. Crystal, it's been a pleasure. How can people learn more about what you do?
You could go to my website, which is fargoergo.com. There are also some free videos that you can have access to, which are all on YouTube. And my handle is @YourAlterErgo. I have everything on there from how to set up your desk, how to complete an ergonomic assessment, and which keyboards and mice might be good for you.
Thanks for joining us today on Main Street.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I certainly learned about ergonomics hearing that conversation. Hope you did too. Hope your workday is ergonomically correct and healthy. On the way, the story of a Czech-born librarian and author who wrote a book about the Damore family in Medora, but wasn't happy with the response to it. Stay with us, but first, this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. As North Dakota schools welcome back students, the boards that oversee their districts have a new state law to comply with dealing with public comments at open meetings. Here's Mike Moan.
The law that took effect August 1st requires all local governing bodies, including school districts, to allow residents to speak at every regular meeting. Supporters say the change is needed because they felt some boards around the state were too restrictive in this area. Amy DeCook of the North Dakota School Boards Association says the new law comes at a time when there's great pressure on those deciding local education matters.
Communities are asking tougher questions about funding. Lawmakers are adding more and more strings to the dollars that they provide. And we are still hearing largely, I think, on a national stage, calls for reform of public education.
Historically, school boards have been non-political, but there's been a larger influence of candidates and parents demanding districts take up culture war issues. The association had opposed the initial bill the legislature considered this past spring, calling it too broad without reasonable limitations. Backers touted compromises along the way, including limiting topics to the current agenda or from the previous meeting. In talking to its members about the changes, the association acknowledged the need for inviting the public to learn more about local school decisions while keeping the heated rhetoric at bay. In crafting their policies under the new law, DeCook says school boards need to make clear what kind of conduct is out of line.
Interruptions, defamatory remarks, or persistent personal attacks generally shouldn't be allowed.
DeCook says it's important that public boards hear valid criticism, but adds disrespectful behavior can interfere with the need to conduct business. She also alluded to ensuring those in the audience follow decorum, suggesting heckling and prolonged clapping can be a form of intimidation to others in attendance. This is Mike Mullen for Prairie News Service.
And work is continuing on the Sentinel project designed to upgrade the nuclear triad. That includes replacing the Minuteman missiles in the Minot area. Senator John Hoeven told Minot's Task Force 21 this is an important project as a deterrent.
We have to have the big stick. We have to have that backstop for our conventional forces so nobody ever challenges us.
Minot Air Force Base, F.E. Warren Air Force Base in Cheyenne, Wyoming, and Malmstrom Air Force Base in Montana are scheduled to receive the upgrades. Minot is the only dual-mission base with missiles and B-52 bombers. Hoeven continues to say this project has to be done concurrently. He says that will save money versus doing it base by base.
We do this concurrently across the enterprise. It gets done in its entirety sooner at less cost to the taxpayer.
Hoeven says so far $5.1 billion has been provided for Sentinel funding. A town hall meeting on Sentinel is scheduled this evening at 5:30 p.m. at Minot State University's Ann Nicole Nelson Hall. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Such an honor to be with you on Main Street. I'm Eric Dethridge for Craig Blumenschein this week. Later in the program, learn about one of the artists, Mike Olson, our roots rock and jazz host, has played over the years. A musician that's not necessarily a household name, but a musician's musician, if you will, that would be blues guitarist and singer Chris Whitley. Coming up next, a real page-turning Plains folk essay from Tom Easerns. Stay tuned.
The FM Kicks Band presents summer big band concerts showcasing the sound of jazz for 50 years. Big band music at Viking Ship Park in Moorhead on September 9th at 3 p.m. Details at fmkicksband.com.
It was Father Bill Sherman who brought the authorial papers of Zena Trinka into the collections of the Institute for Regional Studies and thus available to researchers at NDSU Archives. Using Father Bill's book, Prairie Mosaic, too, we can situate this Bohemian American author into her circumstances on the Northern Plains. Bill's map clearly delineates the substantial concentration of Bohemian settlers in the townships north of Lidgerwood in Richland County, North Dakota. Zena Trinka was born in 1892 in Kolín, Bohemia, present-day Czechoslovakia. Her parents, Anton and Leopoldina, brought her to America as immigrants in 1893, settling in Lidgerwood, where Anton was a tailor. Finishing her schooling there, Zena went to Valley City Normal to get credentialed as a librarian and returned to serve as the first public librarian of Lidgerwood. More than anyone else, Willa Cather educated us as to the distinctive cultural contributions of European immigrants to prairie life, contributions evident in her Nebraska novels, but declaimed outright in her famous 1923 essay on pioneer life, The End of the First Cycle. At a time when Anglo-Americans disparaged immigrants, she argued they were more educated, artistic, and literary than the English-speaking settlers around them. Zena Trinka was of such stock. She had literary aspirations, which surfaced when she moved to Dickinson to direct the public library. It made quite an impression on her when Theodore Roosevelt's old cowboy colleague, Sylvain Ferris, strolled into the library one afternoon and commenced spinning stories. She then wrote and self-published two books, North Dakota of Today and Out Where the West Begins, establishing herself as a regional author. She also commenced writing about her Bohemian roots, garnering enough notice in the old country to be invited to ceremonies in 1938 at Castle Hrošany in Prague and meet President Tomáš Masaryk. Then she boarded a special train to get Americans out of the country ahead of the Nazi invasion. On return to the U.S., Trinka published her best-loved book, Medora, which I have studied, along with her unpublished manuscript in the archives, Colorful Czechoslovakia. She has literary talent that gets lost in flowery romance. All her life, and she spent her later years back in Lidgerwood, she felt unappreciated. Especially in 1956, when she vented her resentments in an angry letter to Russell Reed, superintendent of the State Historical Society. She accused Reed, who had advised a Hollywood film director making a film about the Marquis de Moray, of suppressing her own superior work, the resulting film making a lamentable caricature, she said, of the Marquis. The outburst flowed from a broader disappointment in her literary life. Being an author in North Dakota is not an enviable lot, she writes. It means heartbreak and dying by inches, and it should be engraved on the tomb of every writer worth his salt who lifts a pen in North Dakota. No such epigraph is incised on her gravestone in the Bohemian Cemetery of Lidgerwood. Nor do I intend to exhume any of the unkind remarks Trinka made about other authors on account of her frustration. Given a break or a sympathetic editor, she might have achieved greater fame. Or perhaps the chip on her shoulder was just too heavy for her to take wing. I can only read so much from the dark eyes peering from her author photo plates.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Buffalo's Fire, Native-founded, Native-led, covering local Native news. Buffalo's Fire and Prairie Public will be at the UTTC International Powwow, September 5th through 7th in Bismarck. You can tour the studios of some of Fargo-Moorhead's most popular artists during the FM Visual Artist Studio Crawl. This free family event is October 4th and 5th, noon to 6 p.m. See painters, potters, sculptors, glass artists, fabric artists, jewelry artists, group studios, and more, all demonstrating their work. Peruse the Studio Crawl map at prairiepublic.org/community. I recently heard Mike Olson play this kind of outlaw set, and in the thick of it was this atmospheric bluesy tale from a guy named Chris Whitley called Living with the Law.
Well, I come down from the country, I find the lesson in the draw.
And it got me to thinking deeply about the Texas player and his daughter, Trixie, whom I had the pleasure of interviewing a number of years ago. The apple doesn't fall far from the tree.
You know, so my dad is Chris Whitley, and I grew up touring with him and just being drenched in music.
As you're playing the guitar, do you feel like the DNA and your dad talking to you?
That's the strange thing, you know, like once I started picking it up, it was almost like I was serving the instrument, like there were songs that were there that needed to be told that I just almost felt like I was to the service of it. You know, like I remember just like picking up the guitar one day and just being like kind of just automatically having this like melody and this lyric that came to it. And I was like, well, whether I want it or not, it's like, it's calling me, you know, so I can't really do anything.
So you stopped rebelling against it.
Yeah, I just, you know, I guess I just laid down my swords and was just like, all right, let's do this.
I was born to listen to the oldest voices, but when the world turns silent.
Before debuting with her solo album, she was the singer in Daniel Lenoir's jazz reggae-inspired project called Black Dub. And let me tell you, the young Whitley's pipes really stood out.
From the bottom of the brew to the top of the leaf, the top of the leaf.
Well, talk about full circle. Lenoir, who of course is known for being behind the controls of classic albums like The Joshua Tree, So by Peter Gabriel, Robbie Robertson's first solo record, also recorded Chris Whitley's acclaimed debut, Living with the Law, in his house. It featured another song that you'll hear on Into the Music quite frequently, Big Sky Country.
Now when this is over, over and through. And all them changes have come in past. I wanna meet you in the big sky country. I just wanna prove mama love can last, yeah.
Recalling an early gig in which he opened up for Chris Whitley, blues rock superstar Joe Bonamassa said Chris came out with a dobro and a piece of kick drum wood, and then he just blew the roof off the place. And blew them, Joe and his band, no slouches themselves, out of the water. Joe said, "You're doing yourself a disservice if you don't seek out Chris Whitley." Bonamassa said that it's like if Leonard Cohen had played the dobro, Chris Whitley. He gave high praise to Trixie, too, a fearless artist doing her own thing in Belgium. Make sure you seek her out as well. Chris Whitley died of lung cancer, tragically, way too early, at the age of 54, November 20th, 2005.
There's a death underneath here to receive us when changes fail. May this shovel loose your trouble. Let them fall away.
You can hear the legacy of Chris Whitley's music on Into the Music with Mike Olson. Listen each weekday from 9 till 10, and again from noon to 6 p.m. on Prairie Public's Roots Rock and Jazz stream.
Faith.
You are listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Eric Dethridge. It's so nice to have you along today. Craig Blumenschein will be back with you next week. Well, if you live in an urban area in North Dakota or northwest Minnesota, eastern Montana, it's hard to make out the stars on a clear night. Well, maybe in Montana with the big sky and all. But coming up, Harvest Public Media will tell you about a movement to bring back starry skies in cities. Up next, Alligator Alcatraz. Surely you've heard of this controversial place in the Everglades by now where immigrants are being detained. Well, a recent court ruling could see it shut down partially in the fall, but Florida's Governor Ron DeSantis has plans to fight it. Coming up on Our Living Lands, we'll hear a perspective against Alligator Alcatraz from some of Florida's native communities. If you secretly root for bad numbers out of Wall Street just so you can hear the wah-wahs, well, that's kind of twisted, but it also means you're a marketplace fanatic. If you giggle every time Kai Rizdahl says,
Niner,
then you know dude's an actual pilot, and you can't wait for 6 p.m. Central so you can hear normally dry business news delivered by an effortlessly cool host set to an amazing soundtrack that'll have you reaching for your Shazam app every time. Plus, you listen for stories that feature real people, not just officials.
I'm Ashley Morgan, and I'm the owner of Unglued in Fargo, North Dakota.
Though you'll also hear from people whose mere words can impact your bottom line.
Chairman Powell, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Kai. Great to be here.
Kai and his team bring humanity to the economy.
You know, my American dream, I want to go shopping and it being less than $100.
Marketplace, the business news for the rest of us. Listen weekdays at 6 p.m. Central on Prairie Public.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. In Florida, tribes are fighting to stop a new immigration detention center in the Everglades. In this encore episode from March, Our Living Lands producer Daniel Spalding spoke with Cheyenne Kippenberger, a member of the Seminole Tribe of Florida, about what the area means to indigenous people.
It's quiet, but listen closely. Those are the sounds of the Everglades. Cheyenne shared this clip with us to give us a sense of what her homeland sounds like. Here's our conversation. What are some challenges climate change is causing in Florida?
We're ground zero for climate change in Florida. We're facing rising sea levels. We're starting to see warming and acidification affecting our marine ecosystems and also affecting the Everglades. Natural disasters are going to continue to intensify down here. And what that means is our homelands are taking on the burden of the aftermath of man's actions. And now the people who live here are also going to experience the effects of climate change and suffer. And so we've seen what these hurricanes do. We've seen entire communities be destroyed. And so people's lives are at risk and our drinking water is at risk. It's really scary. Our home is at risk and our ways of life are at risk.
How has climate change impacted the Seminole tribe?
You know, we're battling for the protection and the preservation of our ecosystems. But what challenge I've seen come up like within that is the idea to protect and preserve to like these scientists and these organizations that definitely have great intentions, right? But what their idea of protection and preservation means is to like cut off the public's access. We want to see them be respected and we want to see them thrive, but we also want to be able to access our homelands, whether that's for medicinal purposes or ceremonial purposes, cultural purposes. I think that we're facing, you know, what really is the idea and the practices of preservation within our traditional knowledge systems versus like this newer Western scientific driven idea of knowledge. And, you know, in combination with that, there's also this kind of like uphill battle having to like raise awareness and educate people on why it's important to protect and preserve these ecosystems.
Why do you think traditional knowledge is important as the country faces climate change?
We know these lands. All of our tribal communities have had a relationship with their traditional homelands for hundreds of thousands of years. We've treated it as a relative, and in turn, it has taken care of us as people. And traditional ecological knowledge is based on the foundation of that relationship. It is a practice of respect, of reciprocity and care, and it's a knowledge base that expands across agriculture, across medicine, biodiversity, science, technology, and so much more. And we now more than ever need people to understand why caring for the land, caring for water, caring for the air is of the utmost importance, because climate change is happening. It is happening all around us. And so we need traditional ecological knowledge because we need to go back to respecting and valuing the land, not just for extractive purposes or for its resources, but for the simple fact that without it, we as people cannot survive.
How are you feeling about the new Trump administration, and what do you think its impact will be on the environment and indigenous communities?
I think a lot of us, if not all of us, have been feeling a lot of anxiety and worry, which I think is a very normal and natural reaction to everything that is happening around us. The truth is, it's very intense to be going through what we're experiencing right now. But despite that intensity and what feels like one gut punch after another, you know, as we see some of these orders roll out from the new administration, this is not the time to like curl up in a ball and accept despair as our mindset. This is the time that we really need to care for ourselves, like emotionally, mentally, and physically, so that we can continue to mobilize together, so that we can build community, so that we can build bridges, but most of all, so that we can keep pushing on the momentum of our collective mission. And we want to see not just the survival of our people and future generations, but we want our people to be able to thrive and experience the world the way that we have and the way that our ancestors have.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kuwanic Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
It's Our Living Lands, which you can hear every Tuesday right here on member-supported Prairie Public. Want to let you know that we will be broadcasting live along with Buffalo's Fire at the 55th Annual United Tribes Technical College Powwow. That's happening on Saturday, September 6th. Of course, the powwow is Thursday through Sunday, but we'll give you a good taste from 1 to 3 p.m. on that Saturday. We'll bring you the experience, some of the sounds, and we'll be talking to lots of people as we broadcast live from the annual UTTC powwow. It should be a spectacular event. Hope we can give you a taste of that if you are not there in person yourself. Well, coming up, if you live in an urban area and you're bummed that you can't see the stars at night big and bright, like deep in the heart of Texas, or maybe if you just drive out of town a few miles, Harvest Public Media has got some new ways of looking above. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Danielle Webster, host of All Things Considered weekday afternoons on Prairie Public. I hope you'll join me for a mix of global and national news from NPR and important stories from right here in the Prairie region. I'll keep an eye on the weather for you, as well as fun community events you should know about. It's a great way to make the drive home more bearable. But don't be mad if we make you late for supper because of a compelling driveway moment. All Things Considered, weekdays from 4 to 6 p.m. Central on Prairie Public.
Americans are losing their starry views to light pollution, but communities can make lighting decisions to help preserve night skies while benefiting wildlife and human health. Harvest Public Media contributor Celia Yopis-Jepson explains.
Outside Kirksville, Missouri, there's a state park called Thousand Hills. It's the 12th place in the world to earn a special title, Urban Night Sky Place.
It feels great. It was a lot of work.
That's Ryan Persinger, the park superintendent. He and his coworkers are reducing light pollution by installing better fixtures and bulbs.
The point of this certification is not to just get rid of all of the lights, because we want lights on the ground so we're safe. We just don't want them pointing up so we can't see the sky, or pointing in our eyes so we can't see at all.
Persinger is referring to one of the most important concepts in the growing movement to bring back starry skies. A lot of the wattage that homeowners, businesses, and public agencies use outdoors doesn't actually help us see. For example, picture a lamppost with a glass globe on top. It shines a good chunk of its light into the sky. That portion never reaches the street and sidewalk. Instead, it just escapes upward. Another portion of the light shines out of the lamppost horizontally and ends up hitting people right in the eye and messing with their vision. That's called glare. Thousand Hills State Park is switching to fixtures that are designed to avoid the sky and your eyes. Fixtures with shields that angle the light downward.
They also are the warm color, so more orange than that bright, obnoxious white-blue light.
Those amber bulbs are less disruptive to wildlife and to human sleep. At nearby Truman State University in Kirksville, similar changes are underway, led by faculty and students who have pulled together nearly $100,000 in grants for this. Daphne Broski-Lang helped with that. She graduated from the school last year.
When I would have some late nights working in the lab, I would go outside and it would be midnight or one in the morning, and the birds would be chirping.
Birds were confused by all the light.
It was pretty unsettling, actually.
Plus, some of the outdoor lights were shining into dorms all night. As more lights get fixed on campus, it addresses problems like these. The retrofits keep the lights where it's needed, on the ground, and use amber LEDs, not white.
Overall, they look dimmer when you look at them, but we measured the brightness underneath the lights and we found that on the ground, the illumination level was brighter.
Changes like this could also spell real energy savings if they become the norm. Dark Sky International, the advocacy group that certified Thousand Hills as an urban night sky place, estimates wasted outdoor light adds up to 21 million tons of carbon dioxide annually for the U.S. Vyojit Gokhale is an astronomy professor at Truman and a board member of Dark Sky's Missouri chapter. For anyone who wants to improve their outdoor lights at home, he says,
the three steps are good fixture, low lumens, and then amber color, low temperature.
So for the fixture, get one with an opaque cover to angle the light downward. For lumens, that refers to a bulb's brightness. Don't go brighter than you need. Try using lower lumens on your porch, for example, and see what you think.
There is some subjectivity there, right? What you consider low or what I consider low, it may be different. And that's fine, right? You're doing it for your front porch. but be conscious about that.
Next, for color temperature, Gokhale says look for a Kelvin number on the bulb package, and lower is better.
About 2200, 2700 Kelvin lights, certainly below 3000 Kelvin, or just look at the color, and the more amber colored it is, the better off you are, generally speaking.
One last rule of thumb, he says, make sure outdoor lights have a purpose. Remove the ones that don't, or turn them off when they're not being used. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Celia Yopis-Jepson.
Hear more environmental stories on the podcast Up From Dust. This story was produced by the Kansas News Service and is being distributed by Harvest Public Media.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 26th. On this date, in 1992, the Dakota Clinic and Hospital in Fargo celebrated Dr. Blaine Amidon's 50 years as an OBGYN. Dr. Amidon was a legend in Fargo, known as a war hero, healthcare leader, fencing champion, and the builder of a spectacular mid-century modern home. The celebrated doctor had delivered an estimated 18,000 babies during his long career. But he was a modest man, always saying his patients were the true heroes in the delivery room. Dr. Amidon grew up in East Syracuse, New York. He received his medical degree from Syracuse University in 1942 and began his career in New York City. After completing his internship, he joined the Army and served in the Army Medical Corps. He was among the American soldiers who landed on Normandy Beach on D-Day. A few days later, the drama of war took a different turn. A French farmer approached Dr. Amidon's camp in a panic. His wife was in labor. Dr. Amidon rushed to the farmer's home and delivered a healthy baby named Virginie, after Dr. Amidon's wife, Virginia. Fortunately, home delivery was a requirement when he was in medical school from 1938 to 1942, but Dr. Amidon later said he was relieved that this D-Day baby was the last home birth he ever performed. He moved to Fargo in 1950, drawn by his dislike of hot weather and his desire to practice medicine with a group. Dr. Amidon's career quickly took off. He was one of the founding physicians of Dakota Hospital in 1964 and later served as chief of staff. He also led the North Dakota Society of Obstetrics and Gynecology, chaired the state's Maternal Mortality Committee, and taught at the University of North Dakota's Medical School. In 1984, the Dakota Clinic honored him by naming its new prenatal birthing suite after him. Outside of work, Dr. Amidon took up fencing, and in 1962, he won North Dakota's Foil Championship. In 1959, his wife designed a striking mid-century modern home with high-vaulted ceilings and floor-to-ceiling windows. It's still known in Fargo as the Dr. Amidon House. Dr. Amidon retired in 1994 and passed away in 1997. One patient remembered him simply as a nice man, a modest man, a good doctor, and a good friend to all moms and babies. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Trista Razor Sturza. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
All right, that's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. It's been a pleasure to have you along. I'm Eric Dethridge, and for Craig this week, I'll chat with you tomorrow.